On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Chad Kim about Augustine and humility. So we cover all sorts of topics like why was humility such an important topic for Augustine? What kinds of people attended services in North Africa while Augustine was pastor? What made Augustine an effective preacher? How does preaching work as a kind of sacrament for Augustine? And how can a sermon be what Augustine would call a spiritual exercise? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. We're a podcast that's devoted to serious thinking for a serious church. And when we talk about serious, we mean both a serious conviction about theology and a serious critical mind as it comes to all sorts of ideas and arguments, examining them with the strongest of, I don't know, abilities. But it also means things like charity and curiosity, where we should be kind to those who are different than us and be interested in what they think and why they think it. So we've tried to endeavor to create an intellectual culture that prizes things like that: charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. Today on the podcast, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Chad Kim. Chad is there's cool stuff about this. So he's from the same area that I'm from. So we have all these cool things in common. So I think it's fun for just that. But he's also doing some really interesting work. He's a Protestant publishing with Catholic University of America Press, which tells you that he knows what he's talking about. He's very serious about these things. So this is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to talk about Augustine's theology of preaching and humility. So this should be a great time. So Chad, before I get started with anything, just tell me a little bit about yourself and how did you stumble into thinking about Augustine and his theology of preaching?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks again, Jordan, for having me on. And I know he's not feeling his best, but I appreciate working with me. And so we've tried to do this a couple times. So glad to be able to finally talk with Jordan. And yeah, so we were talking a little beforehand. I kind of gave my background. And actually, one thing I didn't say was I went to a Christian high school where I did Latin starting in middle school. And then we read someone gave me Augustine's Confessions. I actually can't remember if we were required to read Augustine's Confessions in high school, but I had a copy of it. And I lost a friend of mine in high school. In book four of the Confessions, if anybody is familiar with the text, he loses a close friend of his. And just reading Augustine's description of loss and grieving and pain and some of that stuff, you know, when I teach it with my students, I say, even if you don't share his theological convictions, even if you don't understand where he's coming from, if you just read his description of grief, you can connect to Augustine. His humanity, his heart, you know, as he would say, just comes straight through the page. So that's what first connected me. I like to joke that he'd talk about evil as a privation and all these other things that sounded cool. And I didn't know what it meant, but I was like, well, that sounds good. So, you know, that's kind of my entree into Augustine. But
that's awesome. So tell me a little bit, when I think Augustine's theology of preaching, I've heard countless times from people who, I don't know, they're in the trendy cool church stuff, and they're like, the early church, they didn't do preaching. That's just not something that's there. So when we talk about Augustine and preaching, does he actually, when we're talking about preaching, is that actually something that we would have some sort of context for, or is it something completely different?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about how to crack that nut. It's not preaching like I grew up with. I'll say it like that. And so some of it has to do with, accessing Augustine's preaching can be difficult for the modern listener at times, or the modern reader. And there are a few different reasons for that. But And just to make the transition, my book is on Augustine and humility and then preaching. So I you know, the Confessions features in it, which I love, but I got interested in his preaching just because I was curious what he was like as a person and as an individual. And so one of the things that I think does make him interesting as far as his preaching is the sermons. Particularly, there's a collection of sermons called the Sermones ad Populum, which are the sermons to the people, and they're the only unedited texts, at least as far as he indicates, to Pisidius, his kind of student and biographer. And he says, I wanted to edit these, I couldn't. And so what we end up having from his sermons are basically the bare record from a note taker who would come along with him as he preaches. And so if anybody's read on book four in On Christian Teaching, he talks about the need to preach extemporaneously and pay attention to the people around him. So I think to some extent, it can be difficult to follow his sermons because they feel a little stream of consciousness, which they are. So they're not tightly organized around, you know, well, the old saying in Baptist circles was 3 points in a poem. You know, so it's not as tightly organized as that, which can make it difficult to follow. And the other thing that can make them difficult to follow at times for the contemporary reader, if you were raised again, as I was, in a Protestant context, there, you know, he is making some connections that I wouldn't see because he's making connections to sort of to the underlying language. He's moving back and forth through different books. So it doesn't follow like a historical critical or a grammatical historical kind of exegesis. So his exegesis, he would call more spiritual or maybe allegorical, and which Calvin chastises him for in his biblical commentaries. But so those things can make it difficult to kind of connect to him. But what makes him compelling to me and what makes the sermons compelling is that you actually see him engaging with his audience.
Well, this is a safe space, so you can say that Calvin's wrong. But really, why – this is a little bit off the cuff, but I'm just curious, as you're talking about his sermons, why is it that so many of us don't read historical thinkers' sermons? Oftentimes, like, when people get really interested in, like, I want to do retrieval – you're going to go pick out like the Magnum Opus, the City of God, or like the Confessions, and you're going to do that for any number of figures. But the first recourse is almost never, let me go read their sermons. Why is that?
Yeah, good question. I think in part they're not used as much in later writing. So if there's a great 3-volume work by Oxford, The Historical Reception of Augustine, and you know, so when you go there and you see, okay, what was Luther reading? What was Calvin reading? What was Aquinas reading? They're almost never referring to the sermons in those doctrinal or dogmatic works. That being said, his sermons are extremely important to Caesarius of Arles and some of the later medieval preachers. A lot of them would just reread Augustine's sermons. So they don't seem to be as tightly connected to the sort of more reflective systematic treatises. So you won't find them as sources as much for later thinkers. And so I think that kind of makes people less likely to engage them. But they're arranged. So sometimes figuring out how they're arranged can be difficult. And it can, you know, I mean, he has 550, depending on how you count them, in the Sermones ad Populum alone. And some of them will be really long, some of them will be really short. They're just, you know, they're unwieldy in a way, and it's harder to find like a direct reference or an entree point.
Yeah. So as I think about your book in particular and the emphasis on humility, why is it for Augustine that he finds humility so important? And is this unique to Augustine compared to others around his period?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a good question. So I don't do as much in the book in terms of like his predecessors and those who follow him. That said, So Alastair MacIntyre and others will note that like humility is not a virtue for the Platonists or the Aristotelians when they're listed, you know, when the ancient sort of pagan or Greek philosophers are mentioning the virtues, they're not mentioning humility. So there's some debate about this among like some German classicists from the mid 20th century who want to say that there are a few cases where they might say something favorable, but almost no one really takes it seriously among the ancients as a virtue. So in that respect, Augustine is unique and, you know, in his response to sort of the non-Christian tradition. As far as, you know, other people before him, no one places as heavy of an emphasis on it. And part of it is it's part of the fabric of his whole thought, right? So, I mean, the way that he characterizes what Adam does is a prideful grasping for what can only be given, right? And so at the very heart of sin is pride. And what Christ comes to do, and I work on this a little bit in the book, and actually my next book that I'm working on is Augustine on soteriology. So some of this is work that I'm doing in other respects. But the way that he understands literally the work of Christ is the application of humility to a tumor of pride. And so because that is integral to what Christ does, it's integral to the way that he thinks about humility. The one thing that I mentioned in the book in terms of his where he may have gotten some of this emphasis, Ambrose actually preaches on humility in the same sermons that he's preaching about the letter kills, but the spirit gives life, which is his famous key in book 6 to unlocking the scriptures. So as he unlocks the scriptures with Ambrose's preaching, he is actually listening to Ambrose teach about humility alongside this very famous phrase that is kind of for him the way in. And he goes, ah, okay, now I can read the scriptures.
Yeah, okay. So give me a little bit of a teaser before I forget about his soteriology. Can Protestants claim him when it comes to this or not?
Well, so I want to say yes. So there's a couple different ways to go about this. So like I'm trained as a historical theologian, so which can mean lots of different things to lots of different historical theologians, but for the way that we were taught at SLU was primarily trying to explain a thinker in their context and sort of look at their the people that come before them, look at you know, how it works within their own thought, and not necessarily how does that fit with a particular theological tradition. So that all that being said, when I think about his soteriology, there's no reason that a Protestant couldn't receive it. Now, you know, there is the famous line from B.B. Warfield that the Reformation was the triumph of Augustine's doctrine of grace over the doctrine of the church. And so the sort of the application of salvation through the sacraments is a very Catholic way of thinking about it. But in actually trying to explain how salvation works, you know, there's no reason that a Protestant couldn't make use of his language. And part of the emphasis that I'll draw on Augustine himself is, you know, when we think about the word salvation, the Greek word soteria, the Latin word salus, and even actually the Syriac word as well, all have a connotation of health. And so one of the main emphases in Augustine is actually that sin is a disease, and Christ is the doctor who applies the healing remedy, and thus saves, which means to heal. And so for him, that is the primary kind of coloring and image at play for Augustine. So I think that's all within bounds. And I just think T.F. Torrance is wrong about the Latin heresy, but...
Well, T.F. Torrance is wrong about a number of things, so that's okay.
I'll go harder on him than I would on Calvin, I guess. But I actually really like T.F. Torrance, but it makes me so sad because I'm like, oh man, you just didn't read Augustine very well.
Oh, I mean, I feel the same way. I like a lot of what Torrance is up to, but at the same time, I'm like, what? Why? Why would you do that? So you mentioned early on Augustine, him being like extemporaneous.
Mm-hmm.
did that help actually help him as an effective preacher, do you think? Or did that hinder him in some ways?
Yeah. Well, I think it hinders him as far as the reception of his sermons are concerned. So it does make it, and actually we know that Caesarius and others edited his sermons. So when they were sort of repackaged and reused in the medieval period, that it was never as long as it was. Like, so other people come through and edit. And so, you know, that would be one thing to say. So yes, it hurt him as far as his reception. As far as his effectiveness for the individual North African who would go to hear him, one of the sermons that I spend a little bit of time with in the book is actually him talking the readers through his exposition of the Mary and Martha story. And so part of what he does in that section is he says, he tries to set the stage for them. So there's an ancient rhetorical sort of skill called ekphrasis. And ekphrasis in Latin, sometimes it's translated as evidentia. So we get the word evidence, but that is to like draw something before the eyes so that it's able to be seen. And so Augustine is very good as a rhetorician at drawing a picture, painting a picture. What's interesting about the sermons as a record of his engagement with the people is he literally says as he's preaching in the notes that we have, he says, "I can see that you're delighting, and I'm also delighting because I see that you're getting it. And you are seeing Christ for who he is. And just like Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus, we are both sitting at the feet of Jesus, our head, as he teaches the body who he is." And so it's like, it, you know, you do kind of like, and there, those, the, like, that's one really great moment, and they're not as many as I would like there to be, but like, that gives you a little bit of the, like, the character of Augustine. Like, he's just excited. He tells in one of his early letters, I think he's writing to Alypius in Carthage, he talks about weeping with his congregation over their sin. And so it's like, you know, when you think about Augustine as preacher, and people will tell me this in my like reviews in classes often, like people, I get some really negative reviews, but if I get a positive one, it's like, well, Dr. Kim really seemed to care. It's like, I don't know what he was talking about. He didn't always have a plan, you know, yada, yada, yada. We'll get some negative reviews, but they're like, but he cared. And I feel like, you know, that's one of the things that comes through Augustine's sermons is like, he was weeping. He was laughing. He was enjoying it. And he was literally helping them along to try to see what he was seeing in the scriptures, the truth of who Jesus was, but, and is.
I like that illustration. So I think a lot of us, or at least in our popular imaginations, when we think of people like Augustine, what comes to mind is a picture of either like this really isolated monk who lives like in an actual ivory tower, or some like what we would think of as a theologian or a professor today, not so much as like weeping with a congregation. Mm-hmm. So when we think about the church services that he has in North Africa and the responsibilities that he has there, what does that look like on a daily basis for him? And do you think that really shapes his theology in particular ways?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, part of the reason I undertook this dissertation, the book, The Way of Humility, that I'm kind of working off of, was to sort of see what it was like to be with Augustine with his people. And, you know, like I had read Confessions, I'd read City of God, you know, you reread some of the big treatises. But I was curious in the sermons, what do we get? And we do find Augustine saying things like, "I've delayed finishing City of God because look, I'm preaching every day." And so we get, if you read the, like his letters, he makes it very clear. He's trying to be there for his people. He never travels again, right? So after he leaves Milan, the late 380s or 390, he never goes back, never travels again. Never travels again overseas. He goes to Carthage, and he goes to Carthage a fair bit for various councils and such. But he stays fairly local, never really moves. So yeah, I mean, I think I think he, you know, that's what he considered his real task, was to be a preacher first. I mean, you know, there's like some people have tried to guess how many sermons he would have preached. I've heard guesses ranging from 5,000 to 10,000 sermons. Because, I mean, you know, you consider he lived a really long life in ancient terms. So 355 to 430, you know, 75 years. And basically from 391, 392 through 430, he was preaching. So he's preaching for almost 40 years, 38 years, something like that. So yeah, so that was what he thought of what he was doing. So it's not, it's definitely not an ivory tower. He is a monk. He is, you know, does lead a monastery at Hippo. His sister leads the convent next door. People often forget that he has a sister and a brother. And he doesn't mention them in the confession. So they kind of get left out often in the retelling. But yeah, so I think that is true about who he is. I mean, as far as how it shapes his actual theological work, Patu Burns wrote a book on Augustine's preaching in the interim between when I signed my contract and when it was published. So it was a little frustrating in some ways. And also I had to go back and read it and make sure I footnoted it, because Patu Burns is a great scholar. And one of the things that he does that I don't do in my book is try to look at the development of Augustine's thinking throughout his life via the sermons. I am a little skeptical that that can be done, because the sermons are really hard to date. But one of the things that Patu points out, Dr. Burns points out, is that Augustine doesn't preach very much on the Pelagian controversy or any of the details in the Pelagian controversy. So I think, you know, one interesting thing to think about are what are the things that Augustine will say in the sermon, and what are the things that he will write to particular interlocutors who he feels need maybe reproof or something like that. And so he is different. There is a very clear kind of approach when he's preaching versus when he, you know, he's writing to Julian of Aclanum, who, you know, probably was as at least as eloquent, if not more so, than Augustine himself.
So how does the concept of humility track or contrast with his concept of wisdom? So I'm good friends with Benjamin Quinn. He did his dissertation on Augustine and wisdom. And I'm just curious how these two things go together or don't go together.
Yeah, actually, I interviewed Dr. Quinn, Benjamin Quinn, for the podcast. So it has been a year or so since I've read his book. yeah, so wisdom. I mean, so, you know, like to some extent in De Trin and on the Trinity, Augustine thinks that, you know, the full sort of wisdom that we will receive when we become God, you know, like God, become gods, depending on how you want to use the language. So my advisor wrote the book on Augustine and deification. You know, so that there's a sort of eschatological end to wisdom. And whereas like humility is something, you know, that I don't know. There's a couple different ways to think about this. And as I started to say that, I wanted to change what I was saying a little bit and say, you know, he very specifically says that humility is salvific in the confession. So he has this kind of interesting notion that it's actually a Christ as humble and Christ's humble, like humble nature as he becomes one with humanity in the incarnation, or as he is one with humanity in the incarnation, that humility is literally salvific. And that goes to, you know, sort of the antidote to pride is humility. In ancient rhetorical or in ancient sort of medicinal theory, basically how you cured was by applying the opposite. And so humility being applied to our pride. I guess I need to think more exactly where, I mean, so the question of wisdom, sometimes humility is an intellectual virtue. And if the question is, you know, how is one also wise and humble? Then that could, is that kind of where you were wanting to go?
Yeah. I mean, I don't totally know. I'm just curious partly just curious. I have a follow-up question on these sort of things.
is humility even a theological virtue? So I know there's people, like, if you get into the weeds on, like, sort of the ethical sort of stuff, you've got these distinctions of theological virtues and these other types of virtues. Like, where does humility even fit? I don't know.
Yeah, well, so Matthew Wilcoxon wrote a book on divine humility, and I was able to talk with him a little bit about that as well. But, you know, he talks, I think in his book, he mentions that Aquinas uses it as a propaedeutic. Like, it's not, like, you, I think, like you're saying, he essentially goes with Aquinas, or excuse me, Aristotle, saying that it's really not a true virtue in that sense. And Wilcoxon is making the argument that it is a virtue, and he begins with Augustine on that, which I think is right. I mean, I think, you know, I guess I'm going to have to say that I think humility is a virtue. If I guess, I mean, I don't know. I think he wants to say that it's a divine, divine attribute. And that's, there's, you know, some questions about, I mean, I don't think anyone in the tradition says that in the same way that Wilcoxon does. And so I guess you'd have to think about how that is possible. But I think I think humility, there's something about humility that is submission. And so that's something that comes out in some of the other parts of the tradition. But yeah, I think I think you'd have to get into some distinctions about God and God's self versus God in the economy of salvation, and in order to not fall into kind of a Wayne Grudem problem of the eternal subordination of the Son. I'm not really willing to go that direction either. But
yeah, so does for Augustine, does his preaching, or as he thinks about it, is that like a sacrament of any sort? And how does that really function for him?
Yeah, great. Thank you. I guess to be sort of self-disclosing a little bit, I've realized that I don't feel always as well equipped to do the deep philosophical theology. And so sometimes I'm like, I know how to talk around it, but I'm never fully convinced of where I want to stand. But as far as like the sacrament is concerned, he does think that there's something that happens in the words of the sermon. The sacrament gives the reality which it is a sign of in a way that a regular sign doesn't, right? So in Augustine's sign theory, like, you know, smoke signals fire, but smoke isn't fire. And so the fire is the thing that smoke is a signal of, as he says in On Christian Teaching. But the sacrament does something unique, right? There's a way in which it gives that thing to us, not yet in reality, as in it will be in the eschaton, but in a different way than just any old sign. And so he does think that the words of the sermon function in a kind of sacramental way, because when one preaches, one has to begin with the scriptural text. And beginning with the scripture is, for Augustine, beginning with the word. And so as the word speaks through scripture, and then as the preacher pronounces that word, there is some giving of God's self in the moment of the sermon. So there is a kind of encounter with Christ through the words of the preacher as a kind of sacrament, right? So Augustine is not limited by the medieval definitions of sacraments, the seven sacraments, so he has a much more loose use of the term. And another thing about trying to think with Augustine on some questions, whether it be the contrast or the how humility might work with wisdom, just to return to that for a minute, Frederick van Vlieteren, a Dutch scholar, says that you have to be careful with Augustine because he's always a rhetorician first. And so he's not thinking as systematically as Aquinas wants to think. And so when you think like a rhetorician, you're always looking for different words for things. And you're not always thinking about consistency as the greatest goal. And so I think that's one difficulty when we could see this in the medieval tradition as they try to receive Augustine. You can have Scotus Erugena and and Gottschalk of Orbay both using Augustine to argue two extremely contrary positions. So this is another, you know, difficult. I mean, and shoot, Luther and Luther, Calvin, Aquinas, all of the above, right? They're all thinking they're drawing from Augustine, depending on, you know, essentially which Augustine and at what point. So those would be some other things that I would say just as cautions, or at least as things like when you get into Augustinian studies, you got to be aware of. But in terms of how sacraments work, he has a much broader notion of sacrament and very much thinks that the preacher has a unique task and a unique role, especially given an audience that's largely illiterate, right? So we think that roughly 80-85% of the people listening to Augustine on a giving Sunday are not able to read. So if they're not able to read, the only time they're able to hear the word is in the proclamation of the word. And so that is also going to sort of emphasize the sacramentality of his preaching.
Very interesting. Especially that point about him being a rhetorician first is very, very helpful. So I'll take that. I'm always learning things in these interviews, so I love it. So I put that in my cap and I'll use that. So when we think about Augustine and his sermons in particular, would he call them a spiritual exercise of sorts? And if he would, what does that even mean?
Yeah. So the Latin phrase there is an exercitatio animi, and that is we get the word like exercise. He's sort of exercising the soul. And so one of the sermons that I work through in the book is Sermon 152, and he's working through Romans 7 and Romans 8. And actually, after my dissertation was finished and basically the manuscript was completed, I got Han Luen Kanzer Kamlin's book on Augustine and the Will, and she talks about how Augustine changes his view on Romans 7 and Romans 8, whether or not it's under the law or under grace. Anyway, she does some really good stuff on the development there. But one of the things that's interesting about how Augustine reads that sermon and how it relates to this idea of an exercise of the soul is Augustine's not actually always sure himself how he's going to interpret a passage. And so there's a sense in which as he's trying to preach and work through how he hears Christ speaking in the text, he is asking the listener to expand their own minds as they're thinking through a really difficult thing. And I think Paul says the phrase condemn sin with sin or through sin. And there's kind of a, you know, it's like, okay, well, what is Paul really saying? And Augustine thinks that it's an exercise of the soul because the soul has to be willing to say, I don't understand what that means, but there must be a truth about it because God is speaking. And so Augustine says that it creates this chasm where we have a desire for more of God. We have a desire for more knowledge, but we're not there yet. And so that chasm and then that desire that grows as we recognize that we don't fully understand all the things that we want to know about God, it increases the capacities of our soul to be filled up with God. And so he thinks that this is literally training the soul and then he says that what that does is force us as hearers, as listeners, to pray. Because for Augustine, he in a few places he says that prayer is just the desire for God. At root, all prayer is desiring God's self. So when you read a sermon or you hear a sermon or you read a passage and you don't understand what it means, but you desire to know what it means and you desire more of God's self in that passage, he says that you turn to the inner teacher. And when you turn to Christ who lives within you as a Christian, that you're basically training your soul how to pray and how to become one with God in the moment of the sermon. And so that same sermon 152, he begins and he says, this is going to be really hard. I don't know how we're going to get through it. I need your prayers. The great thing about the Latin word for prayer, orare, is we get the word orator and oration. And so when he tells them to pray, he tells them to orate, to speak. But he's playing on the word because they all know that they're not going to speak in the same way that he will. But they are supposed to be speaking to God on his behalf while they both desire for the presence of God in the moment of the sermon.
Wow, that's awesome. So as I think about Augustine as a preacher in particular, what would you say for pastors today are the biggest takeaways from his just overall ministry of preaching and his theology of preaching?
Yeah, it's a great question. My sister says that if I really want to sell a book, I'll write a book that's just the question you just asked me. and she's like, yeah, no, nobody wants to buy a $100 book from Catholic U. You're not going to sell those. But yeah, so it's a great question. What are the things that they can take from it? I think that Augustine just shows you a little bit of himself. And, you know, it's hard. I mean, every person's going to have their own style. But that's part of who, you know, who I think I have, part of how I have learned from Augustine, is to be willing to show a little bit of myself, in the sermon. So some of my joy, some of my delight, to experience the moment with people. And just be comfortable with that. He'll admit things that he doesn't know or doesn't understand. And so that's part of some of what he has to teach is, and you know, that's a kind of humility. I don't think Augustine purely means intellectual humility as we mean it all the time, right? Like he doesn't just mean to be humble as in, you know, don't think that you're right. I mean, Augustine thinks he's right. I mean, if you've read any of the Pelagian controversies or the Donatist controversies, he's convinced he's right. But all that being said, he also is very willing in other letters to admit stuff that he doesn't know. And so I think there's something there can be something endearing about that, right? Like, oh, shoot, like Augustine's a 75-year-old man who's been studying this stuff his whole life. And if he doesn't have all the answers, you know, maybe it's okay that I don't, right? But he still is absolutely and utterly confident about who God is, right? So he preaches on the Trinity, you know, obviously a very difficult topic, but he preaches about it with confidence about the things that he's sure of, and also with sort of, you know, kind of an intellectual humility about the things that he doesn't. This is one that may get me into a little more trouble, but, you know, I think, you know, probably you shouldn't listen too much to historical grammatical exegesis basically, like, you know, I mean, it's fine if you think that Paul may or may not have said that, but Augustine's more than happy to gloss scripture with scripture no matter where it comes from. So we can call this a canonical reading if we want. I mean, Augustine, you know, doesn't know that language from Childs or what have you, but you know, so I think he is not worried in the least about seeing Christ in the Old Testament and seeing Christ speak in the Psalms, and just sort of a reckless abandon when it comes to God speaking in the Scriptures. And so he's not worried. Is that or and you know another one again? I just taught the Confessions for the Greystone Institute, and at the very end of the Confessions, he says, "Did Moses intend to say this? I have no idea. Who knows what Moses would have meant?" and so there's like, you know, trying to chase too hard the original intent of the author, you know, probably is going to make you a little bit more boring. And Augustine's like, I mean, if we're looking for the original intent of the author, we should be looking for God. right. And so I think I think that a lot of preachers could probably loosen up a little bit and not be so worried if this was going to pass the muster in a, you know, class and, you know, New Testament studies or Old Testament studies. And they don't know if Paul was the author or not the author or, you know, whoever. Who cares? Like, I mean, Augustine actually. I mean, that's me, not Augustine. He would say, he actually does say, you should care in a sense, but don't feel burdened by it.
So a follow-up on that, I think this is, for some reason, all the hot-button things we've got hit are things that I think most of our listeners probably are cheering on. So delighting in the Augustinian approach to Scripture over against a strict, wooden, literal, grammatical, historical approach. But I want to take up arms for the grammatical historical person who's saying, oh, wait, this sounds too loose.
Yeah.
So maybe they have some, like, okay, I'm fine with some spiritual interpretation here and there. But when I put forth, like, the classic example that I was shown when I was trained in a literal grammatical historical undergrad, and one of the examples was Augustine's, like, the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Mm.
Everything, like, has a meaning.
Yeah.
It's like, clearly this is crazy.
Yeah.
Because this is way, like, just, this is just, like, way too much. How should we think about, like, is there a sense in which, yeah, maybe there is a little bit too much looseness when we think about this? Or should we just say, yeah, we need to get over it?
What is Calvin is always looking for the perspicuity of scripture. No, what is the is that the phrase that he uses? Well, that'd be the English translation, but he's always looking for, like, the sort of simplicity or the clarity of scripture. I think that's
I guess in his writing he says lucid brevity, but I don't know.
Lucid brevity. So he's, you know, and I take that to be, like, Calvin has the same idea, right? So he has the same disagreement with Augustine on the Good Samaritan. You could tell I've been trying to. So for the Greystone Institute, they like want us to, like, sort of broadly be, you know, it's a broadly reformed. I'm a fellow there. So it's a broadly reformed kind of organization. So I'm always trying to connect, because these guys know the reformed thinkers way better than I do. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just I'm an Augustinian guy. I'm less conversant. So, but I tried to follow up on Calvin a little bit on that. But yeah. So, I mean, can you go too far on that? I mean, so Augustine, you know, Augustine's rules that liberals love to quote is that he says, basically, if it teaches you to love God and love neighbor, what does it matter? And so I could see, again, why a liberal kind of theologian might like that. I'm using overly simplistic language. I feel like I can say that I went to Princeton Seminary for my master's and Oklahoma Baptist University for my undergrad, and then I got taught by Jesuits, Augustine. So, like, I can play in all the fields. Love of God, love of neighbor, that's great. I mean, Augustine, though, truthfully, you know, he says that if there's a sense in which that's not what Luke would have intended, or even, like, I guess Luke quoting Jesus, as long as it's the truth, you he thinks that you'll be judged wrongly if it's not connected, if it's not subservient to the truth, and if it's not exactly what is meant. Like, he thinks we will be enlightened on these subjects at some point. Like, he thinks there is a fact of the matter. And so I think one thing that would be, you know, the tightrope that we have to walk in any of these questions is there the sort of the balance between absolute, like, there's only one reading and there's only one right reading. And then the other extreme that says there's no right reading. There's no one meaning. And so you could basically have the text mean whatever you want. And I think the difficulty that we all have is, like, okay, well, what do we do within the middle? Right. So every time you read the scripture, you're interpreting it. And every time you're translating, I end up teaching mostly Latin and Greek, and I always tell students, like, hey, look, there are multiple right answers to a translation. That's just the fact of the matter. And every time you preach, you're translating and interpreting. So there are multiple right answers. That's how language works. But that doesn't mean that there aren't wrong answers. And so the one way that I would caution someone is, you know, there is a way to go off the rails. And how you know you're on or off the rails is what we're all looking for, right? So in my mind, the historical grammatical, or someone was telling me, so I think I learned historical grammatical as the word at Princeton. And then there's another, what is the other, there's another way to phrase it. But the way that you're worried about going off the rails, so the historical grammatical reader says, well, the way that you know that you haven't gone off the rails is if it's within the context and if it's what that person would have intended. And Augustine just says, well, that's what the rule of truth is. The rule of truth is what's going to be sure that you are on the rails or off the rails, right? And so you don't need some made up discipline in the last 200 years by a German guy to tell you if what God says is true. And I mean, well, again, actually, Augustine couldn't have said that. But, you know, he does, you know, he's going to say, like, you don't need these other strictures that have come about in the last several hundred years to be your guide for truth. So that's where he's going to go with that. I have to say, I'm probably persuaded, although there is, you know, I guess being aware of your context is important.
I love the spice tonight. So this has been great. I already know that there's going to be several people texting me once they listen to this episode saying, I love it. So this is great.
You can send the hate mail to me and I could just dump it in the spam folder.
So I do have two questions here. For the person who's never read any Augustine, what is the place you say you have to start here?
Yeah.
And for the person who has read some Augustine, say they've got Confessions, City of God, his work on the Trinity, the like on Christian teaching, some of the main stuff that is more in circulation, where would you point them to be reading?
Yeah. You know, I'm always an academic, so I'm always going to quote someone else before I say something. But I heard Ben Myers say, and he's an Australian theologian, he said that he thought after he read Confessions that everything in theology was going to be as compelling, and everything in Augustine was going to be compelling. And he's like, and I was sorely disappointed to find out that that kind of, you know, it's really sui generis, right? It's really its own kind of thing. And there's just not much that is as compelling as that is, right? And so there's, you know, so all that to say, I mean, yeah, Confessions is the gateway drug. The hard thing is there's just nothing that kind of hits as hard. Obviously, I think you should begin there. I reread it once every year or two. And when I have to teach an intro to theology class, I teach at a Catholic Jesuit university. That's at this point, you know, a lot of our students are not Catholic or Jesuit or Christian. And so I still teach Confessions because it's a human text. You know, we don't have anything from the ancient world where someone is so, open with the things that he's feeling, sex and his anger towards his parents and grief and all of these things. But if you've read that, if you've read On Christian Teaching, one of them that you didn't name that's great, his sermons on the Psalms are huge, but they are probably where he develops the idea of the totus Christus, which is a really important Christological doctrine or ecclesiological doctrine, and by extension, Christological doctrine. Those are just great. You know, Augustine loves the Psalms more than any other book. Gavin Ortland has the book on Augustine and Genesis. He wrote on Genesis a lot. I don't find that stuff as interesting as the Psalms books myself. I'm trying to think of another place that would be I guess this is another selfish plug. I'm part of the team that's finishing up all of his translations of the Donatist controversies. And one of the things that's kind of just interesting to me as a person who was raised in the faith is how Augustine so carefully reads scripture. So just following him through an exegetical argument, he was talking about David in one of these things that I'm translating, and he talks about how basically there are people in the Bible who were not intended to imitate, who are basically showing us their sin. And he talks about how David shows us his sin. And he says, why? Well, he wanted a woman who wasn't his wife, and he wanted to kill the man who he had just slept with. Do you think we're supposed to imitate that? And so he uses that against the Donatists. But you know, I was just like, man, we've been having these conversations about David and Bathsheba for so long. And so there's I don't know, for me, even just reading him in a very tedious argument with a Donatist is so compelling as a way of saying, like, you know, just how powerful these narratives have been for throughout, you know, not only Christian history, but Jewish history. And we're still trying to come to terms with the scriptures. So I don't know. That would be another one that's just like surprised me that even that has been enjoyable.
Awesome. So you have a podcast. I can't remember. Do you have a website?
It's called ahistoryofchristiantheology.com, which is the name of our podcast. Yeah.
Awesome. So what you guys need to do is go find that right now. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can click it. Go check out all the episodes, keep up with stuff. You talk about like farming and stuff too.
Yeah. Sometimes I wish I was a farmer, but because I've read too much Wendell Berry, I'm sure. I don't know. We've got 12 chickens and we do a lot of gardening, and my sister is trying to get me to go in with her on some chicken tractors. Do the Joel Salatin thing. I have my criticisms about modern economics and our food system. And I'm just the kind of person who's like, well, if I've got a problem with it, I guess I got to do it myself. And stop, you know, complaining about it and do something. I don't know. I know I overly romanticize it. I know, you know, it's a hard and difficult life. And like it was funny. My grandpa, he was a chicken farmer. His family was a chicken farmer in California. And when we told him we got chickens, he said the exact same thing that you just did. He goes, why? Why would you want chickens? He goes, I'd work so hard so that your family didn't have to, you know, grow up dependent on chickens. So I'm like, yeah, I probably do romanticize it, but that's why I talk about farming. Cause I guess as a suburban kid, we just didn't know, what it was like, to have an animal and to care for an animal and then to eat it. And I think there's a reason that a lot of really good philosophical reflection comes in being tied to the land. Augustine would say, right, the good life is an ordinary life, an ordered life, life ordered to reality. So I think the land is a place where we learn to be ordered. And so I don't know.
So for all of you who listen to the end, you came here to hear about Augustine, but you got a free pitch on why you should be a farmer. So that's great.
That's right.
So Chad, this is...
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, you're good. This has been awesome. So check out Chad's stuff. He's doing really cool things. I appreciate what he's doing. Follow up with his stuff at Greystone. As you know, if you follow along with our stuff, I think Greystone's awesome. I think all the stuff that they're doing is really cool. So check out the resources that are there as well. And we appreciate you all for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.